On behalf of the Adult Education Committees of both Congregation B'nai Shurun and Congregation Rinat Yisrael, it's a great honor this evening to greet Rabbi Riskin, who's come from Efrat to Rinat, amongst other places here in America. And we thank you very, very much for coming to join us to speak. Rabbi Riskin really needs no introduction. We're all familiar with his career in America, I believe, starting from 1960 to about 1983, where Rabbi Riskin built up from almost from scratch the Lincoln Square Synagogue and MHS High School. And since 1983, Rabbi Riskin has been the chief rabbi, the Rav Ha'ir of Efrat. He's built the Or Torah institutions which literally have thousands of students and impact is felt worldwide. I'd like to add a little bit. We all know that part of Rabbi Riskin's biography. I'd like to add the following with Rabbi Riskin's rishus. Rabbi Riskin is a builder, and we in America, till this very day, benefit from all that Rabbi Riskin has built in America. Rabbi Riskin really built, to a great extent, the Orthodox West Side. Rabbi Riskin exemplified, when he was in the West Side and in his periodic visits, a sophisticated orthodoxy. He taught many, many people how to bring Rav Soloveitchik's Torah to a broad audience of all Jews, even non-observant, non-affiliated Jews. And in fact, I will say personally that I'm a Talmud of Rabbi Riskin. Rabbi Riskin doesn't know this, but when I was in the Smicha program at YU, I went down to Lincoln Square Synagogue and I literally bought out hundreds of tapes of Rabbi Riskin's shiurim that he gave, adult education classes that he gave at Lincoln Square. If those of you want to listen to, those tapes are available in the library at the Torah Academy of Bergen County. Rabbi Riskin also set a new standard of excellence for yeshiva high schools. And I dare say, as one who's taught in Yeshiva High School for the past 11 years, that the Yeshiva High School experience today is much different than it was and much better, infinitely better than what it was when I went to high school in the 1970s. And there's a major reason for that is Rabbi Riskin's legacy, that with MHS, we've brought the Yeshiva High School education to a much higher level and really has started the ball rolling for improvement. So if you're a beneficiary of this, and the truth is everyone is a beneficiary of this, go over to Rabbi Riskin and thank him for that benefit. I think just one example from just a graduate from MHS, Rabbi Tzvi Sobolovsky, who's a Rav here in Bergenfield, is a product of MHS, and he's a very chash of a Rav here in our community. In Efrat, Rabbi Riskin has been there from the beginning. In 1983, I saw this myself. When I was learning in Gush, and I visited my cousins, Rhoda and David Brandreth, who were amongst the first people that moved in. I know Rabbi Riskin also was one of the first people that moved in. And Efrat in 1983 was not exactly the Efrat of today. I remember when I'd go to visit, I'd always have to bear in mind that I'd have to buy another pair of shoes because things were a little bit rough in Efrat in those days. But it really took a lot of fortitude to live in Efrat at that time and really bring Efrat, help shepherd Efrat to the burgeoning city that it is today. But in my humble opinion, perhaps Rabbi Riskin's greatest accomplishment besides being a builder of institutions is what he's helped accomplish and contributed to Am Yisrael in the last 6 years. Literally, we have, and we don't take notice of it, and we really should take notice of it a little bit more. In the last 6 years, we're witness to a miracle. And that miracle is the resilience of Am Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael, and even a little bit us too, that despite, and things looked very, very bad in the year 2000, only 6 years ago. People were very, very afraid. I remember reading articles about people scurrying to try to find citizenship in Poland and in Russia because they thought they'd have to leave Israel. But there were a number of individuals who really encouraged the people of the residents of Medinat Yisrael, particularly the residents of Yehuda Shomron, to give them the type of fortitude that really allowed them to be able to withstand all the pressure to be able to live in Efrat specifically. It was not easy to live in Efrat for a long time, and other places in Yehuda Shomron. And Rabbi Riskin, I can quote some of the lines that I heard, again, on tape from Rabbi Riskin. I remember you saying, a life that's not worth risking is a life that's not worth living. That really gives a fortitude, gives a meaning for people to be able to dedicate themselves to Am Yisrael. And this one, I'm not sure if I have it correct, so Rabbi Ritson, please be mochel me. At a time when it was very difficult to travel from Efrat to Yerushalayim on the Derech Hebron on Route 60, leading from Gush Etzion to Yerushalayim, and there were unfortunately, a number of Palestinian murders. Rabbi Ritson, first of all, had the courage to criticize, to tell the army they really had to do their duty and remove an overhang, a very dangerous overhang. Had the guts to be able to say that publicly and to be quoted in the Jerusalem Post and else and other media. But I remember Rabbi Ritson said something like this: that Ephrat is the ring in the crown of Yerushalayim. That's what allows us Jews to be able to maintain control of Yerushalayim. So it's really a very great honor for the Tina community to host Rabbi Ritson, and we're looking anxiously forward to hearing you speak, because I'm sure we'll hear plenty of food for thought for the weeks and months to come.
Thank you, Kvod Rav, for a very generous introduction. Morai v'rabotai, I'd like to speak to you about a very serious problem. And the problem which I mentioned this morning was far more serious than the Arab problem, than the Palestinian problem, than the Iranian problem. Because the Arab, Palestinian, Al-Qaeda, Iranian problem is a problem for you at least as much as it's a problem for us. Believe me, Iran will not attempt to nuke Ephrat. Ephrat is too close to Al-Aqsa. And Israel is small Satan. America is big Satan. So the Al-Qaeda Iranian threat is a threat to the entire free world. What's happening in Israel is an internal problem. It's a repeat of the Chet HaMeraglim, in the sense that we no longer believe, and when I say we, I'm talking about much of the leadership, no longer believes in our right to be where we are. That's the most serious issue. The most serious issue is when former Prime Minister Sharon claimed that we were in occupied territory. Because our right to be where we are certainly begins with the Bible and with 4,000 years of an unbroken chain of Jews living in Israel. Our right to be where we are is because the Balfour Declaration was incorporated in the Treaty of Versailles in 1918, after the First World War, with a decision after the Ottoman Empire, the last bastion of Islamic power, was destroyed. The decision was, on the part of the League of Nations at that time, President Woodrow Wilson, the Allied forces, Britain especially, and Britain had the mandate, was to establish 18 secular Arab states and one Jewish state on both sides of the Jordan River. Between 1918 and 1947, November 29th, 1947, not 18 Arab states, but 22 Arab states were formed. Not one Jewish state. And as a result of conscience pricks after the Holocaust, the United Nations decided to give Israel 20% of the West Bank. The East Bank had already arbitrarily been given by England to the Hashemite kingdom from Saudi Arabia. The Hashemites fought the House of Sword. The House of Sword won in Saudi Arabia. The Hashemites also controlled oil. England was interested in oil and gave a gift to the Hashemites, the East Bank that was promised to us by Treaty of Versailles. The East Bank, Jordan, was ratified only by two states, England and Pakistan. At any rate, November 29th, 1947, we were given 20% of the West Bank. The Palestinians also didn't receive a state. 80%. And we accepted the compromise, as we have always accepted compromises. It was the Arab world that said no then, and that was the beginning of the refugee problem when we won the War of Independence. The Arab world said no in 1967 when they started the Six-Day War. And the Arab world said no in 2000 when former Prime Minister Barak was ready to give up 96 to 97% of the West Bank. That's the history. We have a right to be where we are. We didn't occupy anyone's territory, if anything, by wars of aggression against us. Despite the Treaty of Versailles, they have constantly occupied our territory. And how do we account for our actions? How do we account for our public statements? We only speak about security. We never speak about right. We never speak about justice. What's happened and why has it happened? Why have we, to a great extent, bought the big lie that the Arab world has sold to Europe and to much of the world, that we're a kind of South Africa who invaded a Palestinian state? Who made serfs of the Palestinians who lived here. But if anything, the antithesis is really true. To a great extent, perhaps the answer really lies in psychology. The beaten wife syndrome. It's part of what happened in the desert. We needed 40 years to cool off. ונהי בעינינו כחגבים, וכן היינו בעיניהם. We saw ourselves as interlopers, robbers. Listen, Matthew. You've stolen the land that belongs to the Palestinians. To a certain extent, the beaten wife syndrome. The wife who's beaten thinks she deserves to be beaten. And maybe the answer really lies in psychology. But something else has overtaken Israel. What has overtaken Israel is probably the major sin of the Bible. The Bible has two sins. The sin of the scouts which the Ramban, I think, correctly identifies as a sin of loss of self-respect, that to a great extent is true of much of Israeli leadership of late. But I believe that it's the first sin of the Bible. The sin of the brothers of Joseph and Joseph. The sin of sinat achim. The sin of brotherly strife. The sin of Yehuda versus Yosef. Yehuda versus Ephraim. The split between the 10 tribes, Ephraim, and the 2 tribes, mostly Yehuda. The split, if you will, between Tel Aviv and Yerushalayim today. That split expresses much of what's happening in Israel today. Yehuda was the religious one. Ephraim was the wealthier, more worldly. Yosef represented the Grand Vizier of Egypt. External world. And that split is now expressing itself in the religious settler community versus the rest of Israel. The topic that I'm speaking on this evening is Israel after disengagement. And Israel after disengagement is a frighteningly and awfully split society. It's a society in which the College of Administration in Rishon LeZion conducted a sekir, a poll, Professor Dalia Moore. The various sectarian groups within Israel and how one sector relates to another, the most hated being the Palestinians, the second most hated being the settlers. That wasn't true when I came in 1983. When I came in 1983 to an empty hill which was a frat, I came as a hero. Even Haaretz had a full-page story with a picture about my heroism, quote-unquote. And the Israelis who call themselves left-wingers, according to this poll, 67% see the settlers as being most hated. 55% the Palestinians. That's a scary statistic. It explains to a great extent why it is that in the aftermath of Gush Katif, when 7,000 to 8,000 people were driven from their homes and not given other homes, despite the fact that in Israel there were all sorts of television advertisements showing the homes to which the people who were banished from Gush Katif would find themselves. And at that time, by the way, I was not as unalterably opposed to disengagement or realignment or convergence or whatever you want to call it. There was a rule in Tosfos that if you have many answers, not one answer is good. If you have many synonyms, there's something wrong with the whole enterprise. And I went to Gush Katif during the Pinui banishment. And I went mostly to try to make certain that there would not be a civil war, as best as I could. And there wasn't. There was a Kiddush Hashem. The soldiers acted with tremendous sensitivity, and the settlers acted with amazing elegance and aristocracy. But post this engagement, when there were no homes and there were no jobs for the overwhelming majority of those who were taken forcibly from their homes, the country barely responded. Because wherever you are, on whatever side of the political spectrum, these were innocent people who were sent by every government of Israel since 1967 to be a buffer against Egypt and to take swampland and turn it into a veritable garden which exported flowers and fruits and vegetables free of bugs throughout the world. They certainly deserve better. And the only reason is if those of us who live beyond the green line are guilty of some kind of original sin. And believe me, since the Arab press calls those who live in Efrat settlers and those who live in Haifa illegal settlers, if we're guilty of an original sin, everyone who's living in Israel is guilty of an original sin. That's the problem. The problem is that our leadership no longer believes in itself, in its right to be. What was most telling was that when Prime Minister Olmert was in England just 2 weeks ago, and there was Qassam after Qassam hitting Sderot, when it was clear that the result of the disengagement or the realignment or the conversion or the banishment was that it brought us Hamas, that it gave a victory to terror, that it put mainline Israel, Sderot is right near Ashkelon, in daily danger. All he could do was not urge England to condemn the Palestinians, but to urge England to accept our giving up more territory unilaterally so more Hamas and Al-Qaeda people can come in. By the way, there's not one mosque in Gaza which does not preach Al-Qaeda ideology since we left. In a kind of mad pursuit in order to somehow repeat the failure of the last act of banishment. The very individual who was the architect of the disengagement, the Ora Island, in an interview in Haaretz just 2 weeks ago, said that it was an abysmal failure and dare not be repeated, and that the decision was taken without any kind of real forethought or planning. In the last chief of staff, Moshe Bogi Yaalon, said it then, that's why he was dismissed, and of course he's saying it now. What does this mean about our attitude towards the state? What does this mean about our attitude towards the army? What does this mean about the future of religious Zionism? You know, those of you who were brought up in Bnei Akiva understand that there is a kind of mishulash or triangle. If you'll excuse the expression of Trinity. Not the Rosenzweig's and actually Albo's creation, revelation, and redemption. But paralleling that, Am Yisrael, the Eretz Yisrael, Al-Pi Torah Yisrael. But I must tell you, I don't believe that the three aspects of this tripod are all equal. Am Yisrael is an eternal given. Torah Yisrael is an eternal given because without Torah Yisrael, there is no Am Yisrael. That is our national definition. From the moment of Abraham onwards, there's been an Am Yisrael and a Torah Yisrael. According to the Mishnah and Kiddushin, the entire Torah, the Tariag Mitzvot, according to any biblical student, the aspects of the Torah, which Abraham was given, which Abraham kept. Brit Milah, Chesed, Tzedakah, etc. Eretz Yisrael is our gateway to redemption. Yerushalayim, Beit HaMikdash, ultimately world acceptance of fundamental Jewish values, at least Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, if not the entire Torah, see Yeshayahu Perek Bet, and Micha Perek Dalit, and Zechariah Zayin Chetet. But Eretz Yisrael is a test. We have to be worthy of Eretz Yisrael. And Am Yisrael and Torah Yisrael can and have existed without Eretz Yisrael. I use my words very, very carefully. I'm going to say it again. If you call me a heretic here, I'm probably not a heretic. You're living in Teaneck. But where I'm living is a settler, it's a heresy. But it's truth. And all my life I've tried very, very hard to speak what I believe is truth. Eretz Yisrael is a test. We existed for close to 2,000 years of exile as Am Yisrael with Torah Yisrael without Eretz Yisrael. So the three are not equal. And we're failing the test. And don't blame the government of Israel. And with it all, so that you understand my position, I celebrated Yom HaTzmaut with all my heart this year. And every synagogue in Efrat said, Reshit Tzmichat Gulateinu in Tfilah L'Shlom HaMedina. And even without Gush Katif, and even without many of the settlements in Yehuda V'Shomron, we have achieved more in our generation than anyone dreamt was achievable in 1945 and in 1947 and in 1948 and in 1966. And therefore we have a great deal to be thankful for. And remember that the Mashiach is coming not on a helicopter, and not in a Volvo, but on a donkey. And why the donkey? And perhaps if you'll have patience for me, I'll give you another interpretation later on. But why in a donkey? As Rav Herzog magnificently says, because a donkey starts and then stops, goes forward and then goes backwards. Ultimately, he reaches his destination. But it's not a straight line. And if you look back to the Geula in Sefer Shmot, after the Geula supposedly began and Moshe Rabbeinu went to Paro and told Paro, in accordance with God's words, to let the Jews out of Egypt, Paro didn't only not make it easier, he made it harder. And the Yerushalmi puts it very well. It's not arba lishonot shel geula, arba geulot, separate geulot, and for every geula, every stage in redemption, you have to say thank you. That's dayenu. That's what it means. So I'm very grateful for what we have. What I want to try to explain is where and how did we fail? And what can and what must we do about it? And you know, I'm somebody who doesn't believe in blaming the other guy. I think we have to look deeply into ourselves and try to understand where we've gone wrong. And we have gone wrong. So I would ask your indulgence. And I would like to speak to you about Pesach Sheni. But in speaking to you about Pesach Sheni, I'd like to talk to you about two kinds of Jews, the Pesach Jew and the Shavuot Jew. And I want to try to delineate and distinguish between the Pesach Jew and the Shavuot Jew. And I think if we understand very well the difference between the Pesach Jew and the Shavuot Jew, we'll understand, number one, where we went wrong and where we're going wrong. And perhaps religious Zionism will understand what we have to do about it. And perhaps you at Rinat Yisrael will understand what you have to help us do about it. So let me start with the calendar, and let me start with Pesach. And I'm going to try to speak a little bit telegraphically. But I hope a picture will emerge. And I think it's an important picture. Let me ask you a question. When was the first Seder in history? I want to know the date and the hour. The first Seder, after all, Chag, Zman, Chedutenu, Pesach, the time of our freedom, I want to understand when was the first Seder in history. Maybe before I ask that question, I want to ask, that question I want you to answer, I want to ask a number of rhetorical questions. We just finished celebrating Shavuot. How come Shavuot doesn't have a name that describes the festival? Shavuot describes the period leading up to the festival. It doesn't describe the festival. And how come Shavuot is only one day? In fact, you can tell me, how come Shavuot is only one day? What does the Rambam say? Does anybody know? What do Chazal call Shavuot? It's what? It's the Tashlum, or rather I would say the completion of Pesach. And therefore Chazal called it Atzeret, like Shmini Atzeret at the end of Sukkot. That in effect, there is a long Chag that begins on Pesach and concludes on Shavuot. Correct? And therefore Chazal calls Shavuot Atzeret. Very good. Let me ask you a question, or you should ask me a question. What do I eat on Pesach, and what do I destroy for my house on Pesach? Oh, my God. You know, I'm a sickle feminist. So one of my feminist friends says, Brother Lindenbaum, I know, although it sounds peculiar for me to say it, that God is not a female. Because if God were a female, Pesach would never have been created. Pesach is a tough hour. But you all know that we're not just getting rid of the chametz. Everybody says this, the Hasidim say it, the Mekubalim say it, the Mishnagdim say it, Rabbeinu Avraham ben Arambam says it, the Gemara says it, Mishachim Dagav Dagzai. What is chametz? Chametz is not merely dirt, and chametz is not merely leavening. Chametz is Hasa'or Shevi Isa. Chametz is the Yetzer Hara. Chametz is pride. Chametz is the sexual swelling. Chametz is laziness, because you have to keep working on the dough so that it doesn't ferment. Chametz is sin. And matzot of mitzvot, that's what the letters spell. Chametz is bad, and matzot are good. So I ask you a question. What's the major korban that we bring on Shavuot, which is the culmination of Pesach, with Sfirat HaOmer being a kind of holo shaloid between both chagim? What is the major korban that we bring on Pesach? No? Shelechem. If bread is so bad, and Shavuot is the culmination of Pesach, why do we bring bread? So I want to tell you a secret. I don't care what Manashevitz tells you. I'm sorry, person Manashevitz. I don't care what they tell you. Chametz is flat and tasteless. I'm sorry. Matzah is flat and tasteless. If you make chocolate matzah, if you make it eggs and onion matzah, I miss lunch. But matzah, qua matzah, is pumpernickel that hasn't made it. It's half-baked. Exactly, literally, half-baked. How many matzot did you take at your Seder? Because it's not just me who says it. How many matzot did you take at your Seder? No, how many matzot?
Three.
Everybody three? Anybody different? My answer is your rabbi here.
The Rambam.
Rav Soloveitchik, the Rambam, the Gemara, Brochot, Lamethet, Amud Beh. Two.
So where do we get three? The Gemara says, in Brachot Taflamitet Amud Bet, the Gemara says, Kulanu lo poli, hakol modi. Rav Shalman says, Shalom. The Gemara is dealing with, what do you make a bracha over? Do you make a bracha over if you have a whole loaf, or if you have a piece of a loaf broken off but ready to be eaten? What takes precedence? There's a question in the Gemara. But kula alma, lo plige, that on Pesach you take the broken matzah and you put it into the whole matzah and you make the bracha. And they used to have an Iraqi matzah that looked like pita. I had it this year in my favor. Because I wanted to be kind of exactly the way the Gemara says. So where do we get three matzot from? If that's the Gemara, it's the Gemara of Puresha. So where do we get the third matzah from? So the Balei Tosfot, the Rashi says, because of the Ivlecha Mishnah. So the Rambam, who believed me, knew it all. The Rambam says, it's two matzot, it's a matzah and a half. And what about Lecha Mishnah? Says the Rambam clearly in Hilchot Chametz Matzah, Lechem only is Mevatel Lecha Mishnah. The poor bread, the bread of affliction of the Matzah, overtakes Lecha Mishnah. Refutes, nullifies Lecha Mishnah. When was the first Seder? The date and the hour. No? The first Seder, the date and the hour. Leil? Leil, which night? What day? When did the Jews leave Egypt? The 15th day of the month of Nisan. So it was the night of the 15th. What time? What did God say?
Before
Chatzot. What happened on Chatzot? The killing of the firstborn. So when was the first Seder? Before the 10th plague, when the Jews were still slaves in Egypt. Because Pesach is not the time of our freedom. Pesach is the time when God promised He would free us, and we believed Him. You know what the Zohar HaKadosh calls matzah? Lachma de mehemnusa, the bread of emunah, of faith. And even when the Jews got out on Pesach, they got out into an alien cold. Actually cold by night and hot by day. Desert. Without water, without food. And we didn't even have a Torah yet. Pesach is at best reishit tzmichat geulateinu. Much worse than what we have now in Israel, believe me. Pesach, the Jews were still in Gaza, not even in Gush Katif, in Gaza. Rahman al-Islam. That's Pesach. And therefore the matzah is lechem only still. And therefore there's no lechem mishnah. Because there's not yet Torah and there's not yet Eretz Yisrael. When do we get the Torah and the Eretz Yisrael? When? Shavuot. So Pesach is a half-baked Jew. And Shavuot is a full Jew. I'm going to modify this greatly in a little while. But that's what it seems like. Pesach is the beginning of a process. And Sephira
is the count. From the beginning of redemption to redemption promised to redemption realized. What do the Jews have? They don't have a Torah on Pesach, but you know what they do have? They have stories. They have familial stories. Pesach, we're a family writ large. That's Pesach. Pesach, we tell the rags to riches story. How the family started. Very often, especially, you have families that tell family stories. We came to America without 10 fingers. We didn't have anything, and God helped us, and we got things, and we managed. That's better. And families have special celebrations, family celebrations, and families have special foods. And families have special songs. And families have family stories. That's better. Pesach is Sipur. And Sefirah begins with Sipur. And Pesach is family built into the Torah. Ish ser labayit. Every family takes a lamb. And you put the blood on the doorpost. We're talking about a family. You're talking about a family home. And families share a common fate. And that too is Pesach. And families very often march towards a common destiny. And that too is Pesach. And the Sipur, if it's a good Sipur, includes the faith and includes the destiny. That's Pesach. And what's the relationship in families? It is a horizontal relationship based upon DNA, based upon blood relationships. You're a member of my family, and therefore I'll always take you into my house. You're a member of my family, and therefore I love you even if it kills me. You're smart. Doesn't always work. But that's why the Russia in the Haggadah is not somebody who denies God. That's not the Kofer B'Ikar. It's someone who is Motziyat Atzmo from the family, from Klal Yisrael. Someone who says, Maha Avodah Zot Lachem is a certain family kind of ritual. What does that mean to you? To you and not to me. He doesn't see himself as part of the family. And you have to invite him to the Seder. Because if he's family, you have to try to bring him in. That's Pesach. And I want to tell you, there's something very important about feeling family. Very, very, very important. You know, I learned this message in Lincoln Square. There are some people here from Lincoln Square. I learned this message in Lincoln Square. Lincoln Square started in a little apartment. Actually, started a hotel, but then it became a Shabbat shul in an apartment. 150 Western there. And we lived, the shul was apartment 1D, and we lived in apartment 2D. And we were just married. My wife was 19 then, I was 24 then. A year after we were married, we had a little baby daughter, Baki was born. And the original group who came on Friday night did not read Hebrew. But my Madrikin, I had a teacher, I started teaching a Mishnah. That's how we started teaching a Mishnah. Because nobody could teach by my Madrikin. And into this group came a fellow, I won't use his last name, but his first name, Rabbi Avraham. And Rabbi Avraham was an intellectual from Europe. I believe from Vilna. He spoke to me in Hebrew, Ashkenazish in Hebrew, and after davening, he sat with me and he asked me all the apokorsisha questions on Parshat HaShavua. Maknani Ozvaret, he knew all the apokorsisha questions. And I would sit with him for an hour and try to answer his questions. As a consequence, my wife was getting upset because she was trying to keep our baby daughter up, so I should dress her, so she should hear Kiddush. And I told her about Rabbi Avraham. She wasn't that impressed. After a few weeks, she says, does he come Shabbos morning? So I said, no. And she says, well, you're not having much of an effect, so why do you spend so much time with him? I'm good to pass. And one Shabbos, it was before the Eruv in Manhattan, I think my parents were watching our daughter, and my wife and I went for a walk. And we're walking in Lincoln Tower. And I think I see sitting there in a kind of park area, Rabbi Avraham. Shabbos afternoon. He's unmistakably holding a Gemara. It was warm. His head was uncovered. And he was smoking a cigarette. I wanted to make a bracha over him. It was the first matzvil I had ever seen in my life. I am sure, I never saw. I read about them. I heard about them. So I got close to him and I introduced him to my wife. Well, my wife didn't lose a minute. She said, you're the one who keeps my husband an hour after shul. She said, I want to ask you a question. You always ask my wife, my husband questions. I want to ask you a question. My husband has spent many, many hours trying to answer your question. Apparently, he hasn't succeeded very well. So why do you keep coming to shul Friday nights? You don't believe in God. You don't believe in Shabbat. So why do you come to shul Friday nights? Yungarebchinchin. I never forget that. It's the only time I ever heard the expression. Yungarebchinchin. Rebetzin, you know, but not very respectful. Because he wasn't so respectful there. So listen. Let's get it. And my wife sort of smiled. She knew a little bit. So listen. And I can call you this Finichyo. I'm going to sneeze. I may be a heretic. I'm not a Gentile. Ich will sein mit meinem Mishpocha in Shir. I want to be with my family in Shul. That's the point. That's the point. That's the Pesach. I want to tell you something. Many years later, a student came to Yeshiva Mitzvah and had the same last name as Rabbi Avraham. And I said to him, did you have a grandfather such and such? And he said, I certainly did. And I remember as a child when I would spend Shabbat with my grandfather Friday night in the shul, and I've never forgotten it, and that's why I'm here in the yeshiva. He got smicha from us. I told you I'd come back to Pesach Sheni. I had a communist grandfather. My paternal grandfather. And he had a shame.
And he had a Seder that affected me unquestionably. We only read the first part of the Haggadah. On the wall overlooking the Seder were two pictures, one of Stalin and one of Roosevelt. He ate on Yom Kippur. There was Matzah, there was Chaloset, there was Moro. He quoted from Das Kapital, from Karl Marx, along with the words of the Haggadah, only the first part of the Haggadah. There was no second part of the Haggadah in that Seder. And there was rolls and bagels for the grandchildren who wanted. An apple crumb cake for dessert that my grandmother made. Remember asking my mother, is this kosher for Pesach? She said, don't eat. Believe me, that wasn't the only non-kosher food at that stage. But then I realized, you know what Pesach Sheni is? We read about it yesterday. Someone who is rachok lachem uledorotechem. Strange, strange formulation. So initially, Rabbi Eliezer says, the ninth parak of the Sechet Tzachi, he could be ba'askupa shel beit hamikdash Pesach Rishon. It could be somebody who was that far away physically. He was far away spiritually, far away mentally, and he didn't keep Pesach Rishon. And somehow you got to him a little bit, and you made him feel like part of the family. So he makes Pesach Sheni a month later. But Pesach Sheni a month later is a Korban Pesach, and Matzah, and Maror, and Chametz. My grandfather said, and it has merit, and it has value. Because I want to tell you what went wrong in Israel. What went wrong in Israel is that the original founding fathers of the state of Israel may not have been religious, but they were Jews. David Ben Gurion loved bacon and eggs for breakfast, but he came from Plunsk, and he learned in a cheder, and he loved the Bible, and he studied Talmud once a month, a regular Talmud class in his home, and he was a Jew. He was a cultural Jew. He was a sincere cultural Jew, not religious. But he felt part of the Jewish family, and his Jewish family began with Avraham Avinu. The leaders now, Yossi Beilin, who wrote that his grandfather made a mistake, he should have voted for Uganda and not for Israel in 1896 in the World Zionist Congress. Shimon Peres, who speaks about the new Middle East, in 1994 he published his book, that in the new Middle East, it's not history or tradition that counts. It's your relationship with your neighbors. Witness the European Union. What we ought to do is aspire to be accepted into the Arab League. Shimon Peres. And Yitzhak Rabin of blessed memory, Kever Ochel, Marata Machpelah, Nichse Delo Naida, real estate that can be traded away because it's not his grandmother's grave. He doesn't feel part of the family. That's the tragedy. And what religious Zionism has got to do, it's got to make them part of the family. How do we do it? Before I tell you how we do it and how we have to do it, I try to express to you to what extent we have to do it. I'd like to try to analyze for a few moments the Shavuot Jew. The Shavuot Jew seems to be perfect. He has Eretz Yisrael and he has the whole Torah. And if I told you that Sfirat HaOmer began with Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim, it concludes with Sapir. What is Sapir? After God's revelation at Sinai and he gave us the Torah, the end of Parashat Mishpatim, Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron Kohen HaGadol and his remaining sons and the elders went to top Mount Sinai and they saw God. Vayechzu eto Elokim ve'umitachat l'raglav kima'aseh livnat ha-sapir, like the stone of the sapphire, blue white, the heavens. God's words. Tzitzit. Laman tizgeru et kol mitzvot Hashem. Blue white. Tzitzit. You'll hear me very well. If on Pesach the relationship is horizontal, I feel a part of the Jewish family. My friend Reb Avraham, member of the family, we have a bloodline together. And that makes us share a common faith and even a common destiny. The Shavuot has a vertical relationship to God. That relationship to God should add to the family, not detract from the family. Increase the family, not narrow the family. What do I mean by that? Remember a very important pasuk. The Ahavta L'Reacha Kamocha Ani Hashem. What is Ani Hashem doing there? The Ahavta L'Reacha Kamocha. What is Ani Hashem doing there? So the Ibn Ezra says what Ani Hashem is doing there. He says, you know why it says Ani Hashem? Because Ani Hashem barati et kulchem echad. I created all of you as one. Who is the all of you as one? Who is the all of you as one? Who is the all of you as one? This is remarkable. The whole family, Bnei Yisrael, no? The whole what? The whole universe. Who did God create as one? By Yivrei Elokim et Adam b'tzalmo, b'tzalem Elokim bara oto. God created the whole world. Look at the Rambam at the end of Hilchot Avadim. He says it very clearly. He's talking about Avadim Kenaniim, Canaanite slaves. They're all created from the same womb of God. V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, ani Hashem. Once you accept God, you understand that your family is not only Am Yisrael, your family is the whole world. And you understand we have a responsibility to the world. And you know something? We daven every day. And nobody internalizes his davening. Because every day we say Baruch Ato Hashem al Ha'aretz v'al Hamazon. If we're really thanking God for food from Eretz Yisrael, Nodeh Lecha Hashem Elokeinu al Shinchalto l'Avoteinu Eretz Chemda Tovah Rechava. You should ask yourself for every Birkat Hamazon, did I indeed inherit a land? Satinek. Because the prayer is talking about, but we keep on saying it, and we say it, and we mumble it, and we say it quickly, and we go right. Three times a day. His Shechina should return, we should certainly return. We're not returning.
And three times a day, after every statutory prayer, we say Oleinu, that the purpose of Judaism is L'taken Olam B'Malchut Shakai. And who gives a damn which Jew about the world? Matafu. Because we say the words, we give lip service to the words, but we don't mean the words, and we don't internalize the words. Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad means, according to Rashi, that the Lord who is now our God will one day become the God of the world. And my job is to make Him the God of the world. But nobody is acting on it. And that's the Aftal Re'echa Kamocha Ani Hashem. It means every Jew, and it means every human being. And you know what we did with that pasuk? You only have to love Jews who are frum like you. The Ibn Ezra didn't take it that way. Rav Chaim Vital didn't take it that way. The Talmud Mufak of the Ari HaKadosh. And if you look in the Sfadish Yisgurim, you know, before many mitzvot, tinnini, mukhanu, mezuman, lechayim mitzvah, tasei, shekatur. So the Sfarish HaSidurim, tinnini, mukhanu, mezuman, the beginning of the Siddur, lechayim mitzvah, tasei, shel tefillah. Kimo shekatur, which pasuk? Which pasuk? Kimo shekatur? Pardon? No! V'yahav tol re'achon kamoch. I pray to get close to God, so that I should get close to people. Rav Chaim Vital understood. Most Shavuot Jews don't make the sapir relationship, the vertical connection to God in Torah, don't make the connection to extend the family. The only Jews who are frum like you. Do you understand what we've done? And the one who says it most strongly of all is Rav Kook. Rav Kook says, in Arpa Lei Tohar, in Hotzot Musad HaRav Kook, pages 11 and 12, the soul of the Jew who cares about Klal Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael, even though he doesn't keep Torah Mitzvot, I'm translating exactly verbatim, is higher than the soul of the Jew. And Shei Shlomeinu, Jews like us, who keep Torah Mitzvot, but don't care about Klal Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael. The Pesach Jew is better than the Shavuot Jew, who only cares about him and God, not about the rest of the Jews who aren't religious, and certainly not about the world. That's the problem. That's the difficulty. Now let me go back to Eretz Yisrael. There's a Gemara in Masechet Brachot Taf Lamed Beis. I think it's the most important Gemara that I know. If I had to think of one agada that should be before everyone's eyes, it's this agada. Lech rei kishich shichet amcha. Torah says, Pashat Tikisa. God says to Moshe Rabbeinu, go down, your people are acting perversely, they're worshipping the golden calf. Says the Gemara, Brachot Lamed Beis. Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu to Moshe Rabbeinu, Lech Reid Migdulatcha, get down from your greatness. Klum Natati Lecha Gedula Ela Bishvil Am Yisrael. The only reason reason I gave you greatness, Moshe, was because of the Jewish people. Im amcha chotei, if your nation is sinning, atol amali, what do I need you for? Look at this picture in the Gemara. The greatest kollel in the world. And we have a kollel in Orta Restore, we have Baruch Hashem. Over 80 people learning in the kollel. But everybody who learns in my kollel gets a stipend every month, but he has to sign a contract that for every year that he gets a stipend, he must be a rabbi and a teacher anywhere in the world that I send him. Otherwise, he has to pay back the stipend money. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe Rabbeinu, the greatest kollel in the world, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the Rosh Yeshiva, and Moshe Rabbeinu is the Avrech. Lech Rei, go get down from your greatness. Leave the kollel. I made you great because of the entire nation. I made a covenant not with the Kollelikim, and not even with the Shomer Shabbos, not with those in Efrat, and not with those in Dasidek. I made a covenant with the masses of Klal Yisrael. Lech, reid mi gedulatcha. Get down from your greatness and go to the people and bring them back, because I made a covenant with an entire nation. And I'm talking about myself. Created magnificent settlements. Magnificent educational institutions. But most of the settlements have Vadot Kabbalah. You have to get in. You have to be frum to get into them. Or levels. Some you have to be Shomer Shabbos. Some every woman has to cover her head. And some no televisions. Most have Vadot Kabbalah, and even Efrat doesn't have a Vadot Kabbalah. But I didn't understand that if I wanted to really attract non-religious Jews, I had to start a secular school. I only started religious schools, therefore only religious people came. Now it's wonderful. Shabbos is like no place in the world. Shabbos is better than Yerushalayim. You hardly see a car. It's magnificent. I walk the streets of Efrat Shavuot night. I go from one end to another. Now it's I don't cover the last two hills of Dagan and Tamar, and it still takes me an hour and a half from one end to the other. And I see screens of people, hundreds, thousands of people going to shiurim, and it's great. But it's not Klal Yisrael. And we worried about our educational system, but not the secular educational system. And before our very eyes, and Mafdal at one time was doing very, very well. Now it doesn't exist, but it was doing very, very well. I was invited to be the guest speaker at the Mizrahi convention in Yerushalayim. And I said, I didn't know there was a Mizrahi. I don't know what they're having a convention about. The fact is, that we built wonderful things, but for ourselves. And we didn't reach out to the people, and we left them behind. And I told you that Israel is a test, and we are failing the test. Don't blame the Medina, and don't blame those who aren't religious. It's us. And it's you for not coming and helping us. And it's us for not doing what we had to do. Because the fact is that we have a responsibility to every Jew and ultimately to every human being. And we have to recognize and realize that responsibility. I believe we could turn the tide. I mentioned this morning, and I'll say it very quickly. And I'll tell you just one little vignette so you'll understand. I started an experiment 4 years ago. Radio announcements. You see, I know outreach in the diaspora. Together with Roy Buchwald, we pioneered Turn Friday Night into Shabbos and Beginner's Minyan. The whole Lincoln Square was originally a Beginner's Minyan. So I know pretty well, I think, how to do Kiruv and how to train rabbis to do Kiruv in Chutzlaretz. And all of Chutzlaretz is the same, whether it's South America or South Africa or wherever it is. However, Israel is different because Israel, the Israeli who is not religious, is allergic to shul. And he's right, because religion is politicized, because many of the religious don't go to the army, because religion is also corrupt to a great extent. I'm ashamed to say it, but that's the case. That's what happens when you have a monopoly. The Dayan al-Hakima. So how do you reach the non-religious? So 4 years ago, radio announcers, are you curious about Yom Kippur, but you won't go to synagogue? Go to your local matnas, JCC, Merkaz Tarbut Noar V'Sport. Free, as you are. An hour and 15 minutes Kol Nidre, an hour and 15 minutes Neila. You know something? This past Yom Kippur we had over 30,000 secular Jews, Jews who call themselves secular, in over 200 matnasim. And we've placed 15 rabbis full time in 15 matnasim. Now the story. I visit the matnasim. One fellow, Ephraim, in Karim, which is a non-religious, the only probably non-religious area in Yerushalayim. He's doing wonderful work with the artists, with the musicians. He doesn't call himself rabbi, Ephraim. And there's after-school classes. After-school classes, he also loves to work with the little kids. And he makes them Shabbos parties. You know, there are four also in America. They have Shabbos parties, and they have Shabbos mothers, and Shabbos fathers, and Shabbos queens, and Shabbos kings. That's what he did. The head of the matnas, who's non-religious, showed me a blistering letter, because the Ministry of Education sends mefakhim, inspectors, to see if the education of early child care is up to snuff. And she wrote this horrific letter. What kind of religious coercion is going on in your matnas? All this Sabbath nonsense has got to stop. You're not a religious school. Baruch Hashem, Ephraim was asked to leave that aspect of his work. He had no choice. So the kids went on strike, and their parents went on strike, and the Board of Education had to change its mind and had to give in. But that gives you an idea of the kind of work that can be done and must be done. Finally, I want to conclude. Look at the Chumash. Yecheskel Perek Lamed Zayin. It begins with the Atzamot Yeveshot. Hayta la yad Adonai v'yotzienu v'ruach Adonai v'yancheni v'toch habika v'him le'atzamot. God put me in a valley filled with bones. Ben Adam atichyenu atzamot eile. Can these bones live again? I'm going to inject them with spirit and they're going to live, and I'm going to restore them to the land of Israel. And that's precisely what God did after the Shoah. I'm opening up your graves. I'm going to bring the Muslims from the Holocaust to Israel. And the nation will be born again. The same parak, one pasuk later. V'atah ben adam, kach lecha eitz echad, uchtov alav liyehuda v'libnei Yisrael chaveiro, ulekach eitz echad, uchtov alav liyosef eitz Ephraim. Take two sticks. On one stick, Yehuda. On the other stick, Ephraim. On one stick, Jerusalem. On the other stick, Tel Aviv. V'karabu tam echad el echad, and bring the two together. V'hayula achadim biyodecha, and make them one in your hand. When will there be redemption, and when will we deserve Israel? When post-Holocaust, after returning to Israel, religious Jewry reaches out to secular Jewry and makes them one Jewry. When we bring every Jew at least back to the family of Israel. When the two sticks become one stick. That is our challenge post-disengagement. And may we not be found wanting.
On behalf of the Education Committee of Congregation B'nai Shurim and of Congregation Renat Yisrael, we want to thank everyone for coming this evening, and most of all, we want to thank Rabbi Riskin for the charge that he gave us, and may we see his dream realized. Maariv in 3 minutes and 10 seconds. If you don't say the 10 seconds, people don't take it seriously. It just sounds a round number. 10 seconds means you mean business. Where was Mayor last night? Yeah, so last. They can for 1 second and come and rely on the Moshe Teshuva.
Really?
That I understand. That I can understand that. Oh no, that I don't understand. That doesn't make sense. So he has to come. So he can make up the time to come over to Rosh Hashanah. That he has to do. He must do.
What do you take care of the tapes for the? You know.